Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks a lot for listening. Today, if you want to know why the U.S. government hires hackers like Edward Snowden, read the new novel by former U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan. It's all about how vulnerable our electricity grid is to cyber attacks. Remember Dorgan? Not that well known, perhaps, here in the New York area, but he was a populist Democrat from North Dakota in the House and Senate for 30 years. Before retiring, not running for re-election in 2010, big on energy issues, immigration reform, net neutrality, not exporting jobs through free trade agreements, and tough on banking derivatives before the financial crisis. He is now writing novels. Interesting. Gridlock is his second novel. He had a bestseller last year, another energy policy thriller called Blowout. So we will talk about issues that his story raises and get his take on Snowden, fracking, and Congress today, certainly characterized by the title of his novel, which again is Gridlock. Senator Dorgan, it's a great treat to have you here in New York. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much. I've obviously been to New York many, many, many times and enjoy being back. I've been out of the U.S. Congress, out of the Senate now for a couple of years, but I get up here a fair amount.
And your title, Gridlock, refers less to partisanship in Congress, I think the way we usually use the word, than grid as in the United States electricity grid, correct?
Yeah, gridlock I think most people think of these days as the predominant condition of Congress not being able to get things done. But this is a novel. This is my fourth book. I've written this book with David Hagberg. He and I have jointly written two novels now. And this is really interesting and gripping and exciting, I think. The question is, in this new world of ours, the new digital world, where the next war might be fought without weapons that explode, but might be fought digitally with worms and viruses and so on, what if the Russians created a virus and the Iranians stole it and employed a hacker, a drug-addled hacker in Amsterdam, who had the power to shut down the American electric grid, not just for a day, but for a week or a month? And hold America hostage. And by the way, that's fiction, but not far-fetched, because the truth is we're very vulnerable. As you know, the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, recently said the next Pearl Harbor may very well be a cyber attack.
Indeed. And what if it's not what if? The plot of your story revolves around two Iranian agents who pay $1 million for a little flash drive that contains a computer virus that can shut down the electricity system in a keystroke. And some people believe this kind of cyber attack is already underway in real life, that China and Russia and maybe some other countries have already hacked into the U.S. electrical grid and left behind viruses that they can activate if they choose to. I think there was a Wall Street Journal article to that effect. Do you have familiarity with that, and do you have any evidence that that's already the case?
Well, I don't have a lot of evidence. I have familiarity, having served in Congress. I have been briefed on a lot of things over the years, and this is a new age and a new day. I mean, we live in a digital world. We wake up in the morning and turn on our lights, and then we turn on our computers and our cell phones and all these things. But we don't. You know, there's a new threat to our country of worms and viruses and various things that could shut down our water supply, shut down our electric supply. Just 2 months ago, the Department of Homeland Security warned the electric power producers in our country that Middle Eastern hackers are attempting to get into their systems. This is very serious. I've written a novel, is fiction. I think it's a real page turner, but I think you'll still be able to sleep after you read it. But I think it's a really interesting book that has some relationship to some very significant concerns in our country.
So what do you think of Snowden? Maybe you saw the Quinnipiac poll out today that found 55-35 Americans think he's a whistleblower, not a traitor. And in a way, he would say he's doing what you're doing with your novel, lifting the veil on the secret world of cyber espionage that the U.S. and other world powers all engage in.
Well, no, there's a big difference between what I'm doing and what he did. I have two minds of Mr. Snowden. One, I think he did a disservice to this country. I don't admire him at all. I think he did a disservice to our country by providing very sensitive, important material that should not have been provided the way he did it. And I think that gives some comfort to our enemies. I think it's things that make us less safe as a result of them being known publicly. The second mind I have is that the American people, this has started a discussion about the American people need to be very vigilant and make certain and to press their government to understand what does their government do and how does it affect the American citizen. That's also a very important part. But I separate the two of them because I think what Mr. Snowden did is, in fact, a disservice to the safety of our country.
As it relates to the Senate's role in this, I don't know if you saw in the New York Times today, reacting to the Quinnipiac poll, Gregory Treverton, former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council, now with the RAND Corporation, was quoted saying he found Snowden's leaks reprehensible, but, quote, it is kind of paradoxical that it took Snowden to get this debate out. I'm disappointed that neither the intelligence committees nor the administration pushed this debate sooner. What do you think about that?
That's a fair point that he makes. And when you have secret courts in this country and you have a different standard of behavior to try to protect our country against different and new threats, it's very important for the American people to be involved in the discussion about what does liberty mean. What is our country about? What kinds of things are being done and by whom to protect us? So the point he has made is a very valid point.
Before we come back to the grid and cybersecurity in general, just one other thing on Snowden, because supporters of him say, okay, charge him with illegally releasing classified information, but not with espionage, because he doesn't appear to be working for any other country. His agenda is openness and transparency in government, at least he would say. Do you have any sympathy with that argument?
I really don't understand what all the facts are. So if in fact there's not been a conspiracy or coordination with other governments, that's probably a fair point to make. But he certainly did release information that was classified information in a way that could injure this country, in my judgment.
My guest is former U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan, author now of a novel called Gridlock. And we can take your phone calls for Senator Dorgan on the issues that he raises in his book that we're talking about, on some of the other things that we'll get to, as he will comment on things going on in Congress today, like hyperpartisanship and the immigration bill. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you want to give us a call, anything you always wanted to ask a leading member of the United States Senate for a long time but never had one around, now you do. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So what do you think the U.S. should do about the vulnerability of our electricity grid to cyber attacks?
Well, obviously, we have a department called the Defense Department. You know, and they're busy building airplanes and ships and aircraft carriers and nuclear weapons. We really need a defense with respect to the cyber terror that very likely is coming our way. The banks here in New York, by the way, Bank of America, Citi, J.P. Morgan, they have all been attacked. They've all been the victims of cyber attacks going on. They will tell you every day. The Chinese, it's reported, have a white building in Shanghai that is devoted to doing a lot of these things. The Iranians have just spent $1 billion putting together a new cyber attack approach. I mean, they're, you know, so there's a lot going on around the world that
and
ought to concern us.
Is there moral equivalency? I think we have a five-sided building in Washington that's devoted to, no, well, that's the Pentagon, the CIA. You know, some of the things that Snowden was releasing with respect to China and so forth, we know about Stuxnet, the U.S. apparently infiltrating and actually trying to hack and disable nuclear-related computers in Iran. So do you see a moral equivalency here?
Well, Stuxnet has been written about. It's obviously something that there are ongoing investigations about who released information, who created Stuxnet, who used it, for what purpose. I understand the points you make. I've read the same things you've read. There's no moral equivalency between what China, what Iran, what others are doing with respect to cyber snooping and attempting to attack our systems.
Why not?
I mean, that's not what our country is doing.
We are not doing that. We would not do that.
Well, when getting back to Stuxnet, the question is that was, you know, let's just refer to what is in the popular reading.
Right.
Stuxnet
New
was
York
a
Times
worm.
Reporting for
All
the
right.
Most
well,
part. Yeah.
Whatever reporting that was a worm or a virus that was used to burrow into computer systems in Iran and attempt to prevent them from acquiring or making progress on acquiring a nuclear weapon. So it is, you know, is that substantially different? Whoever did that, is that substantially different than a hacker in China or the Chinese government, for that matter, attempting to get into the Defense Department records or to a J.P. Morgan or Citigroup system in the U.S. or Middle Eastern hackers trying to bring down the electric grid in the U.S. I don't think there's an equivalency.
So how do we protect the electric grid?
Well, we do it by, first of all, understanding the threat, and second, spending a lot of time and investment making sure that that we have made it less vulnerable. We have an electric grid that is vulnerable because, you know, it was created many years ago. We have, 200,000 miles of transmission line. We have 3,500 power companies, tens of thousands of transformers that are used to step up and step down power, most of which, by the way, were built outside of our country, most of which are 40 years old and were designed for about 40 years of life. We've got a pretty vulnerable system, and we've got to worry about it and make investments to strengthen it.
And you seem to suggest nationalizing the grid as one precaution, that we have these various regional electricity grids and that maybe nationalizing it would be one line of defense. Am I reading that right?
I don't use the term nationalizing, but somebody needs to be in charge someplace. We have all these you've got local authorities in local governments. You've got state authorities. You've got federal authorities. You've got acronyms like FERC and NERC. You've got all kinds of different interests out there. Nobody is really in charge. In terms of the investment needed to modernize the grid and protect it against cyber attacks, that takes money. But in the last couple of decades now, we've deregulated all those areas so that now there's competition in wholesale and retail markets to drive down prices of electricity.
Right.
So how do you get from the customer in the payment for a kilowatt hour the money necessary to invest in the infrastructure to upgrade the grid?
Do you mean we need higher energy prices in order to protect the system?
We need to spend the money necessary to make sure that the light switch to your house is not in the hands of a hacker in Amsterdam paid by the Iranians to shut down electricity in your house, in your city, your state, and your country.
Another of your themes related is how the U.S. is sabotaging the alternative energy industries in this country, especially wind, if I'm reading it right, by not having enough of a national energy grid. Is that right?
Well, that we don't have enough wind or solar power in this country. You know, there's really good news on oil and gas. We're producing more. We're importing less. That's good news for our country. But we should also be producing more renewable and clean energy than we're producing. And the problem is the sun shines and the wind blows often in areas where people don't live. So if you're going to collect energy from the sun and the wind, you've got to have the wires to move it to the load centers. And we don't have a new modern transmission capability to do that. And we need to change it.
In other words, wind is being produced, for example, but it can only be used regionally. And some other ways that alternative energy are produced can only be used at the moment of production, and they should be able to be stored and distributed further and wider?
Well, we don't store energy very well. When you produce an electron, you either use it or, you know, it's gone. But my point is that where the wind blows and the sun shines is often where you can get the energy, but that's not where the people live. So you need to be able to have transmission so that you can move it over wires, and that's the way that you would get much more robust, renewable, and clean energy in this country, which I support.
All right. We'll continue in a minute with former U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat from North Dakota, and the themes and issues that he raises in his new novel, Gridlock. Coming from North Dakota, many of you already know North Dakota is the fracking capital of the United States. So we will talk about that. We'll talk about some of the other issues that he was interested in when he was in Congress that are relevant today, immigration for one, and we'll take your calls for Senator Dorgan when we continue on The Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with former U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat from North Dakota. His new novel, which raises issues from real life about cybersecurity, especially in our energy system, is called Gridlock, written with David Hagberg, who I guess is the thriller writer in the duo, right?
Well, David is a veteran fiction writer and a very good writer. I had not written fiction before, and it's, you know, my first two books are about economic issues. And these two are new to me, but I'm learning, and it's very interesting.
So it's interesting that you would write in favor or speak in favor of alternative energy, given that your home state of North Dakota has this huge economic boom taking place, because I think it's accurate to say it's the fracking capital of the United States. That's true about North Dakota, right?
Well, it's the biggest oil play on the planet at the moment, yes.
Because of the shale.
Because of shale and because of hydraulic fracturing, yes.
Right. So how much of a pro-fracking guy are you? Environmentalists say this new jag we're on for oil and gas will lead us into decades of new dependence on fossil fuels, maybe with as much global warming impact as with the old kinds of technologies because of methane, plus the new risks of local pollution from the drilling.
Well, we've been doing hydraulic fracturing for 50 years. I mean, this is not something that's new. And
something's new about it order to let this recent boom take place in the last few years.
It's used in a different technique with horizontal drilling that's allowed us to access oil from shale, but that's what's new. The point is, like everything else, I suppose, if you're doing hydraulic fracturing and you don't have effective regulations that are enforced with best practices at the wellhead and the wellbore, then you got problems. If you do things the right way, you don't have problems. The hydraulic fracturing in the Bakken Shale in North Dakota, there's not much controversy about it because, first of all, the shale deposits are 10,000 feet below the ground, about 150 foot thick. They go down, find those under high pressure, do the hydraulic fracturing. And we've not had any substantial difficulty, but there will always be some outlier companies that don't do what they need to do. That's why you need enforcement.
In other words, it's about safe fracking.
Absolutely.
And you think there can be such a thing as safe fracking as opposed to dangerous fracking.
I do.
Have you seen the movie Gasland? We're going to have Josh Fox on the show soon because he's got Gasland 2 now. And, of course, there was the scene of the water coming out of the faucet, flaming on fire. Mm-hmm. You have any reaction to the movie?
Some of it not accurate. An interesting movie, I think. I certainly think he has a right to raise questions. But it's also important to have a back and forth with respect to the facts and what is accurate and what isn't. So I'm not suggesting that we should not have very substantial oversight. I am saying this, though. You know, one out of every 8 barrels of oil produced in the world is used in a pickup truck or a car in the United States of America. We're prodigious users of energy, and we have had about 60% of our oil coming from outside of our country. Now it's down to just under 40%. We're producing more oil and gas. Natural gas is pretty inexpensive at this point. Using natural gas rather than coal, for example, in the power plants reduces pollution, not increases it. So there's a lot of things going on here that we need to consider. You ask, why do I care about renewable? Because I think our future needs to be much more reliant on clean energy and renewable energy, because we have to have a lower carbon future. If we care at all about this planet and there is a climate change issue we've got to deal with, we need more renewable energy.
Is there any inaccuracy in Gasland that, you would identify? So I can tell Josh Fox, hey, Senator Dorgan said this wasn't accurate.
You know what? It's been a long while since I saw the first Gasland, and I read an analysis of it by people who I respect. I mean, there have been all the sides were chewing on it. But there were some important and real questions raised about certain parts of it. But, I wouldn't just dismiss everything. Yeah. And I'm sure he's a creative, interesting guy who's doing good work, but I'm just saying that there were some areas of inaccuracy, but I don't recall because it's been a while since I've seen it.
Let's take a phone call. George in Brooklyn Heights. You're on WNYC. Hello, George.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask your guest. I could see what his interest is making it seem as if there has to be a lot of things bought, new equipment and all. But isn't it true that the more problematic electric switches would be the newer ones, the ones that are made for control by computers? My light switch on the wall is not a problem in this scenario because it can't be controlled by a computer. Old equipment can't be controlled by computers because it was built before computers?
Right. Oh, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Your thought that some of the new systems that come in could very well
be more vulnerable because they're more
attractive to
driven.
The bugs and the viruses. A very interesting point. But I would make this to you. That old light switch in your house or, these old switches, the issue is not going to be whether those switches are subject to some sort of bug by a hacker somewhere. It's going to be the electricity that's delivered to your house well before you switch the light on in the morning. And we have three interconnects, the Western, Eastern, and Texas interconnects. Then we have about 127 control centers. This is a very complicated system, and almost everybody who's looked at it worries very much that this is a vulnerable system that we need to be very concerned about having hackers and others shut it down.
Reuben in Stamford. You're on WNYC with Senator Byron Dorgan. Hi, Reuben.
Yes, good morning. How are you? Hi, Senator. I guess what I was interested in, I was reading some information about Germany, and they're way ahead, on renewables, and I think it's projected by the year 2040, 50% of their entire country will be run on renewables. And it just seems odd that, a place that is not very sunny, can power that many stations for that many people. We can certainly, I think, do that, but I just don't think we have the political will. We have these great ideas. It just doesn't seem to really move the legislators to be able to, make these decisions. I think that's where the controversy is. It's not that the decision isn't a good one. It's just no one can make it.
Well, there's an old saying, if you don't care where you are, you're never going to be lost. And that's true for a country, I suppose, because we don't have a destination in mind. We should. In the Senate, I pushed very hard for a national standard on what percent of our electricity should come from renewables. And, we didn't get that done. We got it out of the Energy Committee in a bipartisan vote, and then it got blocked. And now you wouldn't even get a ghost of a chance of getting it done because there are those who say, well, you know what you're doing? You're picking winners and losers. And I said, no, I'm for picking winners, not losers, but I'm for picking. I want to have a country decide, here's where we're headed. We want X percent of our electricity to come from renewables. Let's drive towards that achievement and that goal. But the caller is absolutely correct that we have that approach is blocked in the current Congress.
Do you think that it's special interest money that blocks that kind of what sounds like common sense when you put it that way? Pick a total target and then let the market try to meet it. What's actually the obstacle?
Well, two things: regional interest. Energy is both can be both partisan, but also in more cases regional. And second, there's a tsunami of money these days in politics, and the Supreme Court decision, made it much, 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 much worse. And so, it's very hard to get the kinds of things done that we should get done for the country's future.
Though I guess an argument against even picking a target percentage of energy that comes from renewables is you don't really know what's going to come down the pike to make the most affordable, most productive energy sector. Like, nobody probably predicted this natural gas boom 5 or 10 years ago.
That's correct. That's right. But that doesn't do anything to refute the fact that we need cleaner energy, and we need to be less reliant on imports from the OPEC countries. Look, I support and think it's good news for our country that we're producing more oil and gas here at home. Needs to be done the right way, but I think that's good news. And when we buy oil from the Middle East, enough of that oil spills from the barrel to fund the terrorism that threatens us. So I think but at the same time that I think that is good news, I also believe that the mix of energy in our future needs to be cleaner and it needs to be more renewable.
Elliot in Manhattanville, you're on WNYC with former Senator Byron Dorgan. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Good to talk to you. Happy Manhattan Henge Day.
Manhattan Henge Day. Oh, this is another one of those days where the sunset lines up with the east-west grid. Is that what that means?
That is correct, sir.
So what's the best time? You mean when the sun is going down, we should all go to one of our streets and look west?
I read online that the best place is in Long Island City, slightly south of the Pepsi-Cola sign.
All right.
But I don't plan to be there.
All right.
Anyway,
everybody on the G train right now or whatever goes there. Okay. Go
exactly.
ahead.
Senator Dorgan, I was wondering if in your long experience in government, you can remember a time when there were so many vacancies on the in the judiciary of the United States, with nominations pending in the Senate and not being acted on.
Yeah, no, it's unbelievable. Not just the judiciary, especially, of course, the judiciary, but also so many presidential appointments that are needed in some of these agencies that are held up. In the U.S. Senate, the nomination process is completely broken. You know, the Republicans have just decided that we're just not going to move these things. And it's sort of Byzantine to me because you need to fill these positions. There are good men and women who are nominated and then never get a vote.
And so I think Elliot's question also, you know, suggests that the politics of the Senate are changing, that it's more difficult to get the vote today than it was. And it goes to the whole larger issue of the tone of the Senate and how it used to be less petulant and more bipartisan than the House, where the passions of the House would go to cool off in the Senate before becoming law or not.
Yeah.
But something seems to have changed.
Well, everything has changed. I mean, it's not just the Senate, it's the country. Get in your car, drive down the road, turn on the radio. Well, we can tune in to you, but you're different. Tune into some talk radio someplace, and what do you hear? Or some cable television shows. That's all changed in the last 20 or 30 years. And what they're preaching in many cases on all sides is, look, if you go to the Congress, to the government, and you decide on a difficult issue that you're going to compromise, shame on you. That meant you caved in on your principles. You wouldn't stand up for what you believe in. So compromise is a four-letter word now.
It does puzzle me a little bit that this is happening in the Senate, because people often blame it in the House on gerrymandering. You know, the House is now divided into more safe Democratic districts mm-hmm. and more safe Republican districts, so those representatives have incentive to be very partisan. But senators are still elected statewide and therefore need to build more political coalitions to get elected. So why isn't that insurance against Senate hyperpartisanship?
Well, I think I'm a Democrat, so let me give you my perspective, understanding that I'm a Democrat. I think Republicans are very, very concerned these days about primaries. They're not so concerned about the general election in their state. They're concerned about a primary. And that means that you're going to get a primary. There's some evidence of this happening. Utah, Senator Bennett's a good example. If you're not way off to the far right on virtually every issue and you start compromising and sounding reasonable, you're going to get a primary opponent and may well lose. And so I think there's less interest in compromising because of self-interest in avoiding a primary fight. At least that's how I observe it.
Problem on the Democratic side as well as the Republican side? Less, I think.
Less so. I'm not suggesting one side's all right and one side's all wrong. But if you look at the record and the previous caller asked about holding up nominations to the judiciary, it's pretty clear who's holding them up. That's not confusing. The Republicans have decided they're not going to cooperate with this president and move some of his nominations. That's a shame because they should cooperate.
And at least let them submit to an up or down vote. We have just a few minutes left. Let me touch on a couple of other things going on in Congress right now that I know you worked on in your legislative career. Immigration. House Republicans in their caucus yesterday soundly rejected the bipartisan Senate bill. Do you see any path to yes with comprehensive immigration reform?
Depends on the Speaker of the House. If Speaker Boehner decides I'm going to drive this through my caucus somehow and provide real leadership with danger to his leadership.
Already proven that he can't that because the Tea Party caucus is too strong.
If he's not going to do that, then the immigration bill is not going to happen.
How could he do that?
He could. He has a rule in the House that the only thing I will bring to the floor of the House is something that has a majority vote in my party.
Right.
He could decide that that's a rule that he will avoid and will get as many Republicans as is possible and bring a bill to the floor of the House that will get most of the Democrats, so you could pass an immigration bill. But I don't think he's going to do that. The answer to the question, however, is it's up to the Speaker of the House. If he decides to make it happen, I think he could make it happen. I think it's unlikely.
You were a major critic of regular banks becoming Wall Street investment firms. You were among what I might call the prescient few in Washington, unlike the senators from New York, by the way, willing to be independent from the banks more than a decade ago and warn against deregulating the kinds of fancy derivative riskiness that contributed to the financial crisis. So how much do you think the Dodd-Frank law has fixed the problem?
It's a baby step, a step in the right direction, but a baby step in my judgment. You know, if you are a bank that is too big to fail in our country, you're too big and ought to be broken up. That's not radical. I mean, you know, that we've done that before in this country with enterprises that are too big. And the second thing is the banks are still gambling. You know, they could put a craps table in the lobby just as well. They're gambling with people's money with derivatives in which they have no insurable interest, what are called naked credit default swaps. Look at the record. See what they're doing right now. Some countries have outlawed them, and I believe our country should, but we still have banks trading naked credit default swaps in which there is no insurable interest. That's flat-out gambling.
And last thing, and it comes back to the themes of your book, do you like President Obama's new executive orders on global warming and power plants? He wants these old-style coal plants to be retrofitted with expensive technology to reduce emissions. Some supporters and opponents alike of the president say that'll indirectly put the coal industry out of business in the United States because they won't be able to afford these retrofits. Do you like the policy?
Well, in the president's State of the Union address, he told the Congress he was going to do this unless the Congress would work with him. So I think what he's saying is over a period of time, we'll wait, we will implement some of these policies unless Congress will work with them. And my best hope would be that the Congress would work with them because it's not partisan and it ought not be between the Congress and the president. All of us ought to understand we have a real problem with respect to climate change. And so we have to work on these issues. And let me also at the end of this say again about the book, because I came here, as you know, we've talked generously about it at the start. But this new novel, this is my fourth book, and this is an interesting novel, I think, that people will enjoy, that describes some really serious problems, I should say, in the future for this country. We've got to defend against cyber terrorism. And we've got to worry about what all this new digital age means with weapons that don't explode, but weapons that could cripple this country.
You want to talk about your protagonist team, your heroes, for just 30 seconds or so? You have a journalist among them, right?
I have a Nate Osborne, a Medal of Honor winner. I've got a journalist named Ashley Borden who drives a pickup truck with, you know, the name of the newspaper on. Yeah, I've got some really interesting bad guys and some interesting characters in this book. I think it's an interesting novel available on Amazon. Again, it's called Gridlock.
By Byron Dorgan and David Hagberg. Senator, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending so much time with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, it's Marriage Week on The Brian Lehrer Show. Today, Emily Yaffe, the advice columnist from Slate, takes your calls on monogamy, infidelity, and some gray areas in between. Stay with us.